Hey, welcome along. It is 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time in North America. That means 5 p.m. in the Canadian Maritimes, 5:30 p.m. in Newfoundland, 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, 10 p.m. in Western Europe, 11 p.m. in Egypt, and midnight in Moscow. And it's the weekend. It's Saturday. For all our Asian and Pacific listeners. And we welcome you to another live edition of our Clubland Q&A, special Friday edition caused by various legal inconveniences, which meant we had to postpone Tuesdays and do it on Friday instead. Today, by the way, is the second anniversary of when... CRTV and its college loan billionaire proprietor began suing me. And they've spent the last 2 years suing me. And so far I'm winning and I intend to keep winning. And I thank all of you who have stuck with me during the last 2 years. It's been not a 2 years I would wish on anybody else, but I'm super grateful still to be here because it wasn't 2 years ago when they started pulling all their... they breached my contract and all that kind of stuff. I didn't think I would be here much longer, and I'm glad to be here. Come and see me. I'm still alive, and just about. And Dennis Miller and I are going to be in Pennsylvania and New York State later this month. We open the 22nd of February in Reading, Pennsylvania. And if you want to come and see us there, that's quite near for, I think, near for the Jersey Shore and Wilmington, Delaware, and various other places. Reading, Pennsylvania, and that's February 22nd, and the tickets are selling super fast there. So I think basically the orchestra and the loges are gone, but there's still some mezzanine and balcony type seating. And then on the 23rd, we're in Syracuse, New York, and then later in Rochester and the dreaded Wilkes-Barre. I've given interviews to people in that town, and I still can't get a definitive pronunciation. They kind of avoid saying the name of the town when... So I'm going to stick to the Wilkes end of town, and I'm going to leave Dennis to play Barre, or whatever the hell it's called. Anyway, we would love to see you there. And you can even get special tickets where you get to meet Dennis and me after the show. And so that's fun. If you want a special performance of selected highlights from Feline Groovy, that's extra. But you do get to meet Dennis and me after the show. Let us get to your questions, which have been pouring in thick and fast. Midwestern Tim says, do you think we're all paying too much attention to Miss Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? When Trump ran for president, there was a lot of blowback aimed at the MSN because of all the free advertising they gave him. Could it be that we are making a superstar out of AOC by paying attention to her a little too much? I don't think so, actually, Midwestern Tim, and I'll tell you why. Because, for a start, she knocked off a Democrat Party power broker. I'm not sure what that means, actually, a Democrat Party power broker means someone, I think, who spent most of the 1980s wearing blackface. By the way, we will be having the Democrat National Committee, who will be, they're standing behind me entirely in blackface, as is their want at DNC meetings, and they're going to close out the show today with Rockabye Your Governor with a Dixie melody. You won't want to miss that. It's lovely. Anyway, I don't think we are. She knocked off a big Democrat power broker at the age of 29. 29? And she's where the energy of the party is. The Democrats are moving left. But they're stuck because of the way the system in this country favors incumbency. Even as the party is moving left, they're stuck with the same old faces. And even when you've got left-wing faces, you want them to be appealing personalities. I mean, for example, Elizabeth Warren is basically it's Hasta la vista, baby. She's gone. She's on her way out. The fact that she actually basically pretended to be American Indian and has conceded that she identified her race as American Indian, whereas I always say she's the whitest white since Frosty the Snowman fell in a vat of whiteout. The fact that she did that 30 years ago. So, like, you have 30... This is round about the same time that the entire Virginia Democrat Party are all capering around in blackface, moonwalking, doing their Michael Jackson routines and all the rest of it. While they were pretending to be black, she was pretending to be Cherokee. And the fact that that's... There's actually an important point in there that they'd much rather have Kamala Harris or they'd much rather have Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, because if you prioritize identity politics that much, why go for a fake black or a fake Cherokee when you can have the real thing? So I don't think that, and I think it's actually quite important to have, if you're going to have these kind of policies, you're best to have them sold to you by an appealing personality. When I was guest hosting Tucker a few weeks back, we had a little discussion about this, and somebody said along the way that they hope she challenges Chuck Schumer, which I can well see. Because who do you want peddling hardcore left-wing socialism to you? Some unlikable shark, some beltway operator like Chuck Schumer, or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. It's not really that much of a competition. Let's see, what else we got here? AB43 says, I must say that the Democratic Party is a perfect political organization for our time. Half the party is busy with plotting how to organize a coup to depose a duly elected president. The other half is very busy coming up with a green plan which quadruples or even increases tenfold the progressiveness of the predecessor of the current president. I think I got that right. I can't actually find a question mark anywhere in there. It sort of ends. I don't know where the question went. Hard to object to that. John Schuber says, I just figured it out. Modern progressivism, not to say socialism, is a religion. They may have taken God out of it, but they are still promising heaven. They've just moved the finishing line to the here and now rather than to a point after the final curtain. The Green New Deal is a revivalist movement. The kingdom of heaven, if you embrace the faith, lower your carbon footprint and give up T-bone steak. Tom Wolfe called the 1960s the third great awakening. Is this the fourth? I don't think societies can live without any kind of transcendent meaning for very long. So if you abandon religion in the form of Christianity or whatever, you find yourself searching for substitutes. And we now have a substitute religion in place. It's got all the characteristics of a religion, not least heresy, apostasy. And I think there's, I think it's actually hard to live a life without meaning. And it's easier if you're a member of a real religion. It's actually quite tough if you take that religion seriously, to live according to your faith. So in a sense, it's easy to retrofit religious aspects to elements of secular society, particularly the sort of humbuggery that attends secular progressivism. It's made for religion. In a sense, there are aspects of moral vanity about it that are appealing to people. On the other hand, it lacks the critical ingredient of a true faith in that it does not, unlike Christianity, it doesn't provide for any kind of forgiveness or redemption, as we see with those unfortunate Democrat minstrel players down in Virginia. E. Williams says, Mark, do you think the AOC crowd will actually succeed in taming or turfing out Nancy Pelosi and the rest of the elders of the party? Or will Nancy's slow clap slowly kill the AOC wing of the party? And is a slow clap better or worse than jazz hands? Don't do the jazz hands because you find yourself singing, Mammy! And then you might accidentally find yourself being governor of Virginia. I think this is where the future of the party is. This is where this is how they think. I mean, I don't want to be cynical or anything, but if you look at Kamala Harris, for example, she checks multiple boxes. She's female, she's half black and half Indian from India, not Indian from wherever Elizabeth Warren comes from. And I think if you go on about this stuff all the time, it comes to seem important. It comes to seem important to you. The first Latina this, the first Muslima that, the first transgender this. Eventually that becomes... I think they should find... That's what was so weird to me. I think Cory Booker queered his chances when he... came out as heterosexual a couple of months. I mean, the fact that he said... He felt the urge to come out of the closet and declare himself to be heterosexual, for whatever that's worth. I'm not sure he's a practicing heterosexual, but whatever I don't know. But the fact that he said that it was slightly weird, because basically I think he damaged his chances in the Democrat primary. I think it's going to be an all identity politics all the time. Primary. And the only question in that sense is whether in the end, if you look at Bernie, for example, Bernie is like the oldest old white man ever. And if you've got Bernie policies, everyone basically now is running as Bernie, but in a more appealing shape. And it's interesting, nobody's pretending to be Hillary Clinton. Nobody's pretending to be centrist. They're all for universal healthcare and federally run pre-kindergarten and all the rest of it. That's where the energy of the party is, and that's where it's going to continue. Let's see what question we got now. One can always this Babs from Cali like my crack about. I was talking about Holsteins in Vermont. And for you non-dairy farming type, I said the Holsteins are black and white. So they look like the governor of Virginia when he's only removed half his makeup. And Babs from Cali wants to know why people are listening to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Because I think one of the problems with big government means that everything becomes political. I've made this point before. I mean, if you go back to when poor old McKinley was assassinated, just under 120 years ago, people were upset because the poor fellow was shot. But he didn't actually, the President of the United States at the beginning of the 20th century did not actually impinge on people's lives that much. He had certain very limited policies, but government was a lot smaller, and in particular, federal government was a lot smaller, national government was a lot smaller, and it made it a lot easier because as I mentioned once or twice, the difference between the American system and the Canadian system and most others is that in America, the head of state and the head of government are the same person. That's to say, the president. In Canada, the head of state is the queen and the head of government is the prime minister. And if you're a non-monarchy, like, say, post-imperial Germany, the head of state is a non-executive president and the head of government is the chancellor or the prime minister, you can combine the two, but it's easier to combine the two and accept the guy as a national head of state in an era of small government, When government gets big, everything becomes political, and therefore your head of state becomes a partisan figure. And if you have government as big as government is now in the United States, it sort of necessarily means everything becomes hyper-partisan, and in a 50-50 country, 50% of the people hate the president. And it's a terrible situation. I'm not sure what you do. I'm not sure what you do about it, but it becomes, I think it actually, at a certain point, people's expectations of government are so high. I mean, I find it very odd, for example, America has a constitution, and there's a constitutional court that interprets that constitution. And that's very important, which is why the battles over confirming judges are so vicious and partisan, as vicious and partisan as any political election. But at the same time, what you understand from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is that actually, to people of her generation, it's not clear the Constitution has any great purchase on them. They think in ways that are, post-constitutional in many ways, that the government should be providing a living wage for those for you, that the government should be providing you with federal kindergarten, that the government should be federal pre-kindergarten, federal nursery school, that the government, federal daycare, that the government should be providing you with your health care. And at that point, it is basically a post-constitutional consciousness. And that's interesting to me, because that transcends constitutions. Because the biggest guarantor of liberty is when the people act with the disposition of a free people, when the people lose the habits of liberty, which you can certainly see in other parts of the Western world. I'm not sure where you go from there. And that again ties into all this free speech stuff we have now, all the way people are destroyed because they went to a party in blackface in 1979. In a sense, when people accept, for example, an essentially totalitarian view of opinion, in other words, that you're not entitled to your own views on transgender bathrooms or climate change or Islam or whatever. Once you do that, you've actually conceded free speech, for example, you've lost the habits of liberty. Once you submit to the idea that there's an official position on transgender bathrooms, you're in a small part of you has lost the habit of liberty. And if you lose it on a couple, three, four, five, six things like that, then essentially you are no longer. If you lose the habits of liberty, it doesn't matter what your constitution or whatever says, because you've lost the habits of a free people. Todd Williamson says, "Dear Mark, when I first seriously began studying the history of America's founding, I was both surprised and comforted to find that there has always been a struggle between liberalism and conservatism. Regardless, during America's founding and until fairly recently, the goals of the political left and the right were the same, to produce a strong and free America for its citizens. They disagreed on the means, but they agreed on the end result. The difference now is that the political left has a different vision for the end result. They seek to completely destroy the vision of the founders and recreate it according to their liking. I am reminded of a chilling scene from the movie Independence Day where space aliens, likely illegal space aliens, no doubt, are on the verge of destroying the planet when the president, still thinking negotiations are possible, asks a captured alien, 'What is it that you want us to do?' And the alien scarily hisses, 'Die.'" I think you're right about that. That's you. In a sense, I should have read your comment before I said what I just said. I think that the reason Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a hit with young people is because she is unencumbered by constitutional hang-ups. And I also think once government reaches a certain size, it becomes very difficult to have genuinely conservative government. Then you're actually in a different sphere. So you can have parties. Here there's a frozen party system. So the parties have the same names that they had in the mid-19th century. And you can keep the names, but essentially you're no longer in the same game. And that's the world that most of the Western world has moved into, in part because people's expectations are different from government. For example, if you don't have economic security, and essentially this is the view of the globalists when they meet at Davos, and they raise it tentatively in public, but they talk about it a lot more in private, that there's going to be nothing for anyone to do. There's going to be nothing for anyone to do. That within a little over a decade, maybe, 30% of jobs worldwide will be gone. And you think about, so again, we've gone with this thing that the whole delusional thing about immigrants, we need immigrants to come here to do the jobs Americans won't do or whatever. We need to have mass migration. There's no economic rationale for that. The jobs that that immigrants do, for example, fast food and whatever, are being automated. Agricultural labor will be automated very quickly, very quickly. Truck driving will be automated. The danger facing our world is that just as we've screwed up our societies and made them essentially switch them from cultural entities or ethnic entities, as most European states were until a few years ago, and turn them into economic entities where you justify turning your society into a multicultural country on economic grounds. The economic rationale for that is gone. And so you will have fractious tribal societies in which there is nothing for most people to do. And the big tech guys all accept this. They understand this. They understand that they're going to be, the elites are going to have things to do because they're going to be devising little toys for everybody else to distract them with so they don't get all kind of uppity and revolutionary and want to smash everything up. In the interest of social tranquility, you're going to need far more sophisticated iPhones. They're going to want to have them plugged into your cerebral cortex so you can be soothed and sedated with moronic entertainment diversions like pop songs and GIFs and videos and what have you, just to keep everybody all quiet from rising up and overthrowing the globalist elite. That's a set. We're now, as I said the last time I was here, we're now in the intermediate stage between functioning society and the futuristic dystopia. And they're actually very serious about that. And actually, the idea that 30% of jobs will be gone by the end of the 2020s worldwide, and it will be increasingly difficult for people to lead lives of human dignity, simple human dignity, is actually a huge challenge to us now. KB says, Mark, 30 years from now, when Pelosi, Schumer et al. Are gone and AOC comes of age and the Democrats get everything they want, do you think she and her cohorts will enjoy the world that she helped craft, i.e. parents have the right to kill their children beginning with conception to 2 years old, people over 65 euthanized, people taxed at 100%, all law enforcement and guns removed, open borders so that anyone, including those from Somalia, can walk in unchecked, no quality medical care, no more combustible engines. I don't think they actually think about these things in the long term. And I don't actually think they think about the intersection of these things. Intersectionality is a big word on the left, but they don't actually think about how things like abortion rights intersect with fertility rates, intersect with immigration, intersect with cultural I don't think they think about any of that. I don't think they give a moment's thought to it. And I think, in fact, one just as they destroy the past, so that even, you know, it's not just statues from the 19th century, but even things that people were doing in the 1980s or in the 1990s, like all the attacks on Seinfeld and other 90s sitcoms. It's the reason you know it's revolutionary. The reason you know it's Cambodia is because for the progressives, it's year zero. It's year zero. They reset the clock. And one consequence of that is not just that they have the arrogance to write off the past because it doesn't think like them, but they write off the future too, and they live in this moment. The fact is that by the end of this century, there will be over, for example, you go back, here's the thing, you go back to 1950, Europe had twice the population of Africa. By the 1990s, it caught up. They were equal. And now they're accelerating ahead. So that there will be 4 billion people in Africa, supposedly, on the UN statistics by the end of this century, in a continent that actually can't support a quarter of that. So they're not going to stay in Africa. You can't have a situation where Africa has basically two-thirds of the population of the planet and expect them all to stay there. They're going to just take a short ride across the Mediterranean and they're going to overwhelm it. Unless people get serious about actually defending their societies while they're, and actually get serious again about the idea of a functioning nation state. Well, but that's far more relevant to the future, because it's actually happening now, than speculating about the sea levels in the Maldives in the 22nd century. This stuff is crazy. Dave Gorak writes, what's your take on Trump's apparent abandonment of his campaign promise to create an immigration policy that puts, quote, American workers first? During the SOTU, the State of the Union, he said he wanted to increase legal immigration. I think, in fact, he said he wanted more legal immigrants than anybody ever. Why should American workers vote for a guy who, in effect, says he wants to cut their wages or even put them out of work? By the way, Trump also said we need more foreign workers to work for the massive number of American companies returning to this country. Which companies are they and what kind? How many? No country needs. I agree with you. I don't know what the hell the president meant. I think sometimes he just says things because they happen to pop. That wasn't in the script. He just sort of improvised that line, as I understand it. And I think sometimes he says these things just because he wants to be liked. I will say, however, that it is a general problem when people talk about immigration in this country, because this country basically is a massive illegal immigration problem. And you see this from conservatives all the time. You see it quite a lot on Fox News, for example. People always say, oh, no. It's illegal immigration is wrong. But I'm all in favor of legal immigration. I love legal immigrants. We need to increase legal immigration. We need more guest worker programs. It's just people just shouldn't be able to walk into the country. They should have to do the paperwork. The reality is, at the end of the second decade of the 21st century, no developed society needs mass immigration from anywhere. It's crazy. It's actually crazy. It's a huge, imprudent thing to do. And it's madness. And I understand that it's a tough break if you're born in Yemen or you're born in Djibouti. And compared to being born in Norway, but you don't make Djibouti or Yemen better by denuding those countries of of the most dynamic are their human capital. I never understand it when people say, "Oh, this idea that there's more Ethiopian doctors working in, I believe it's Chicago, than there are in the whole of Ethiopia. In what sense is that good for Ethiopia?" So I don't think there should be any mass. I think mass immigration is a ridiculous thing. Sol writes, Professor Carlson's blistering monologue on progressives and blackface was worthy of a college course, a continuous source of which is needed to counter the college courses producing delusional dunce queens like Alexandria or Cumbus. Oh, cruel, cruel soul. Shouldn't this have been announced on St. Patrick's Day or April Fool's Day? The planet still has 11 years and 10 months left. If I understand the Democrat Party, the important thing about the Green with Envy deal is that AOC wore green to announce her party's intention to eliminate internal combustion engine automobiles. Afterwards, Chuck Todd asked her how much of this is generational or how much is ideological. With the irony living loudly in her, AOC said it's both and added, "I also believe that like all big movement moments in American history, young people are putting the gas in the tank to really accelerate our timelines on reaching our goals." Tucker's editorial at the top of the show, like 5 minutes before I came on yesterday, was actually brilliant because he pointed out it was really on the theme of liberal hypocrisy. And I always find this interesting that, yes, there are bad people on both sides of the aisle, and badness is not a, wickedness is not a particularly partisan thing. But there is a particular kind of wickedness that attaches itself to progressives. And I think it's because it's actually not possible to live seriously according to progressive pieties 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. I think it gets to you. I think the strain of it is crazy. I mean, as Tucker began by saying, there are three state top statewide elected officials in Virginia, and all the white people among in that top three, that's to say two of them, because the lieutenant governor's black, but the other two wore blackface. That's actually statistically improbable that 100% of the top three white male Democrats in the state of Virginia wore blackface, not in the 1880s, but in the 1980s. And I think one of the things is, if you think about Tammy Bruce and I had an interesting conversation about this, just kind of backstage, offstage, somewhere or other, at the time of the Harvey Weinstein, Matt Lauer, Charlie Rose thing, about why it was liberal men who were these predators, why it's Matt Lauer who has a button that locks you in the room so he can have his way with you, that it's Charlie Rose, the parody of the impeccably liberal, progressive PBS host who's walking around naked in front of young ladies who are a third his age. There's Harvey Weinstein, the man who's made more Oscar bait chick flicks than anybody in human history, who's made more movies with strong, supportive, affirming, you can have it all feminist roles for strong female leads, who's actually assaulting, I think it's almost up to 200 women now, actually, the last time I checked on the list. And I think it's because, and Tammy and I were talking about this, and Tammy was saying, well, I think if you work in a conservative environment, if you're a young lady, your expectations are different and the general expectations are different. I mean, you think about it, you're a young liberal chickie and you get a job at PBS and everyone around you holds the correct attitudes on everything, on climate change, on gay marriage, on transgender this and Muslim that. And they're all on the right side. And the people you know who disagree with you, they're all on the wrong side. You know, maybe you've got an uncle at Thanksgiving and he doesn't believe in same-sex marriage and he doesn't believe in climate change and all the rest of it. And so they're wicked people and you're on the in the vanguard of the progressive utopia. And then Charlie Rose, who you worship, it's been the great privilege. You've been looking forward all your life. You've dreamed of, you know, he's an icon. He holds the correct views on everything. And suddenly he's like walking around naked in front of you. And I think actually, I think the reason it happens more in the liberal environment is because essentially humbug and hypocrisy is built into it. Because you can't actually live with all this, all identity politics all the time without it driving you a little bit nutty, I don't think. I think at heart, people know it's a crock. People know these progressive pieties are a crock. And the only way they can get, and if you, and that's why like Schneiderman, whatever he was, the Attorney General in New York, who had to resign shortly after Samantha Bee had just said he's like a superhero and everything. I think it's actually incredibly difficult to live with that stuff and take it seriously without it actually driving you mad at a certain level, driving you to do insane things. Like, why would Elizabeth Warren, you know, if you want to do things for Native American people, the point about affirmative action is that it's supposed to help people who don't go to Harvard get to Harvard. So when Elizabeth Warren pretends to be Harvard Law School's first woman of color, she's actually preventing a real woman of color from doing that. So, like, I don't believe in affirmative action. I think it's horrible and stupid. I think it's like neo-apartheid. But the fact is, it's actually... Well, it's like a sort of reverse apartheid, but if you had a system of reverse apartheid in which white Afrikaners in South Africa are suddenly pretending to be blacks, in some strange way, it's certainly weirder and it's even worse. And that's how they do things. I don't think it's coincidence. I mean, in a sense, you couldn't have anything better. If you had to think of any way for identity politics to destroy itself, it would be hard to think of anything more ludicrously apt than blackface. Blackface isn't really a thing. I mean, it was a thing in the late 19th century, and it was a thing when they introduced talking pictures. And Al Jolson came out and said, "Mammy, it was a thing. It was a thing then, but it isn't a thing now. It's not. It's hardly been a thing within living memory." And the idea that, as I said on the radio a couple of days ago, the idea that you have the most impeccably progressive party in history, obsessing on identity politics all the time, super woke, hyper woke to everything you can be woke about, and it turns out they're all in blackface, spent the 1980s in blackface, moonwalking around, and the idiot governor comes out and says he didn't put a lot of shoe polish on his face because you never want to put too much on because, you know, it's quite hard to get off. And he's talking to people as if everybody, who among us hasn't put shoe polish on our face? you couldn't ask for a more apt, a more beautifully insane embodiment of the insanity into which identity politics drives you than the Democrat Party is a party of woke mammy singers holding impeccably progressive views, but with all these blackface pictures of them turning up. I don't know. I don't even, I mean, would you honestly want to bet that they're not still wearing blackface? It's extremely bizarre. Scott writes, AOC cannot be laughed off or dismissed. I'm truly scared by her. There are powerful forces behind her. One way for the global elites to suppress the growing populist movements around the world is to restrict travel and people. People will allow this to happen if they're told staying home is good for the environment. You have to get up early to beat me on this stuff, Scott, because you can go back like 15 years and I was saying this kind of stuff in one of my, but isn't it America Alone or in After America? You know, that their Monday night poker game in, I mean, this is like they're restricting freedom of movement. That's one of the core freedoms. And it's not just, you say Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the British Conservative Party, so-called under its idiot leader David Cameron, actually toyed with the idea of giving people an annual carbon allowance. So, for example, if you, you know, you might want to go and vacation, take a long-haul vacation to go to Thailand or to go to Australia or to go to Florida or whatever from the UK. And they'd give you a carbon allowance, so you'd only be able to do this once every 5 years. It doesn't get more totalitarian than restricting freedom of movement. Now, when the Soviets did it, they hadn't got quite a good cover story. And that's why, as I say, on their Monday night poker game in hell, Hitler, Stalin, Mao, and Mussolini must have been sitting around thinking, oh my God, why didn't I think of that? We're doing it to save the planet. The idea that you can be, and this is how it will work, they'll impose, this is how it will work, that if they do bring in this carbon allowance thing, it will be for you. It'll be for the documented portion of the population. They'll still have open borders and undocumented people just walking in, but you'll have, the documented people will have a carbon allowance that will mean you'll only be able to fly to your vacation pad in Florida once every 6 years. They're serious about this. They have the confidence. And this, again, this is what happens. I think this is one of the, to do with the atomization of society that attends the sort of cyber reality, which is now more real than real reality. Because one thing you notice is that increasingly people aren't connected to their towns or their counties or their states or whatever. So the idea of actually, again, it's a line from After America, but I think it's absolutely true. There was some schoolhouse that they wrote to President Obama because they had peeling paint. I forget where it was. It was in Georgia or South Carolina or somewhere. And they wrote to President Obama after his, and he read it out in, I think it was his first or second inaugural or the State of the Union or whatever it was. And he said that he'd had this heartwarming letter from this schoolhouse in some rural district somewhere or other, and they didn't have enough money to paint their school. So they had peeling paint in the schoolhouse. And the school girl who wrote to him said, we're just ordinary school children, we want to finish school and go on to save the world. And so he was, I don't know what he was proposing, like a federal schoolhouse painting agency that would organize the painting of your schoolhouse from Washington, D.C. or whatever. But the vanity of that, you know, why should, what chance does someone who can't even, you know, Who wants to take lessons in saving the world from someone who can't even save their schoolhouse? It actually isn't that difficult, if you've lived in a small town, to organise some kind of community touch-up to paint the weathered old Grange Hall or whatever it is. it isn't that difficult. I've been part of that thing myself. A lot of that small town life can get to you. But it's better, it's more rational than it is writing to King Barak in Barakingham Palace to beseech the sovereign to institute a schoolhouse painting agency to paint your schoolhouse so that you can graduate from school and go on to save the world. Anyone can save the world. That's the thing about the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez stuff. It's about striking attitudes. It's actually a lot more difficult. It's a lot more difficult to save your town, save your school district, save your county than it is to save the world. And you see that all over the map. All over the map. It's a lot more difficult. And actually giving people the tools to save their own communities is a lot better than distracting them with all this planet-saving nonsense, which is ridiculous. Paul Cathy says, I actually worked in a dairy in Twin Falls, Idaho, when I was 18. It had exactly this mixture in its herd. 2/3 Holstein for volume and 1/3 Guernsey for richness. Ah, Guernsey. I love milk from Guernsey cows. It was great milk, great milk. So you're saying for the best milk, 2/3 Holstein. Well, you know, Usda has totally wrecked the taste of American milk, by the way. That would be one of the things I would do. I would have some serious rollback on Usda regulations with respect to dairy farms. But that's your recipe, Paul. 2/3 Holstein, 1/3 Guernsey. And the flatulence left a wonderful pecan afterglow. It will be a sad world when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has created the flatulence-free utopia. That will be a loss. The loss, you may not think so, but you will miss bovine flatulence when it's gone. Ken writes, isn't it likely that most or all of the pro-New Green Deal, Great Leap Forward Democrat 2020 contenders are primarily in it for campaign donations from the climate change Kool-Aid drinkers? They know they can't win, but the grift is too lucrative to pass up. Well, I think that's certainly true. I wouldn't disagree with that. I mean, when you look at like Tom Steyer and people, it's not just that that's where the energy is on the left; it's also where the money is. James Morphew writes, the lingering question I have is how long will the silly proposals continue and be taken semi-seriously by some significant portion of America? This is how the decline begins in the banana and petro republics. Some promises of free stuff from the resistance as its leaders blame those rich or white or right guys. Enough uninformed people expecting that free stuff to support the enactment. The resistance then gets the guns. And then we have the ensuing fight for the shrinking pie as in Cuba or Venezuela. I suspect a large majority of America really does not fall for these silly, unaffordable, impossible proposals and is suspicious of free stuff. But I may be too optimistic. I do think you underestimate there the appeal of attitude striking, which increasingly, I think once things get to a certain point, if you look at Europe, for example, things got to a certain point, and then in Italy, they decided to vote real. In Austria, they decided to vote real. Even in Scandinavia, in recent elections, they voted more real than they have done. I mean, what's interesting in Scandinavia is that you have centrist parties now saying things that the crazy alt-right, far-right, extreme-right anti-immigration party was saying just 5 or 10 years ago. In other words, things that they would have denounced as racist and unacceptable and hate speech 10 years ago, the so-called centrist mainstream parties are now saying. And I think when you look at what's happening, not just in places like Hungary or in Austria, but if you notice, politics in continental Europe has, at a certain sense, got more real than it was 10 years ago. And that's the point. It's very hard to suspend reality. That's a luxury. and you reach a point where you can no longer afford that luxury. And I think it's an interesting question. That's how we wound up with President Trump, is that for people in the rust parts of the Rust Belt and other parts of the country, neither the Democrats nor the Republicans were doing it for them. They had a choice as 2016 campaign got underway, and they didn't like either of the choices because things had got so bad. And that's not societal collapse. That's just lack of jobs, lack of human dignity, cultural estrangement. The idea that there's no one, for example, in the old days, not that old actually, your daughter could get a nice job as the dentist's receptionist and marry the dentist and lead a nice middle class life. And now your daughter has to go to work and there are no jobs except doing the night shift at the Quickie Crab. And there's nobody to marry except heroin addicts or heroin dealers. So we have collapsing families in rural white America. Rural white America is now taking on the same majority illegitimacy rate that you see in black families, among the urban blacks. And these things are not small things, and people understand at a certain level when people are just, you know, when you're just being told, people are talking about irrelevant things to you. Even the whole sort of, you know, talking about blackface or talking about pretending to be a Cherokee or talking about, I mean, none of these things are important if your town's collapsed. And at a certain point, reality does assert itself. Unfortunately, to go back to what James was saying, the silliness tends to continue to a point where it's just slightly too late to get serious. David Giler, however you said, I like this point. If you've commented on the death of Stalin, I miss it. You're referring, I think, to the motion picture. In the rising enthusiasm for socialism, this movie captures socialism by experts, as Solzhenitsyn put it, in the words of Tom Wolfe. Moreover, said Solzhenitsyn, the system had not begun with Stalin, but with Lenin, who had immediately exterminated non-Bolshevik opponents of the old regime, and especially the student factions. It was impossible any longer to distinguish the communist liquidation apparatus from the Nazi. David, The Death of Stalin is a film that came out last year. It was by my old friend Armando Iannucci. Armando is known in America because he's the guy who created that show, what's it called, with the lady from Seinfeld, Veep. Where she plays the vice president. My friend Armando Iannucci, I worked with him for years on terrible BBC light entertainment shows. We were colleagues at the Daily Telegraph in London, and Armando makes some terrific television and films in the UK and also over here, like that Veep show, which I think has won a ton of Emmys, although I must say I don't really like those cynical political shows because in a way they always make politicians more interesting and appealing than they actually are. But anyway, Armando made this film last year, The Death of Stalin, and it's a fantastic movie in many ways, and it's sufficiently rooted in reality. The opening scene, which I think gets to the insanity of, actually sums up the insanity of the world of the late Stalin era Soviet Union, is Stalin is at home and he's listening to the concert, the orchestral concert from Moscow over the radio, on Soviet state radio. And he calls up the control room At the end of the concert, he calls up the control room they're told it's Comrade Stalin on the phone. So they're terrified because they know people are just randomly taken away to die. You never hear from them again. So you don't want to give the wrong answer to Comrade Stalin. And he says he's enjoyed the concert so much he'd like to have the recording of it. And the guy says, sure, no problem, Comrade Stalin. I'll have it brought round and delivered to you at your dacha tonight. And then he goes into the control room and discovers that for one reason or another, they haven't actually recorded this concert. So now he's screwed. He's going to be killed. He'll never be heard of again. So he has to go back. As everybody is leaving the theatre, they're streaming out of the theatre from the concert. He has to go there and stop them. Stop, stop, stop. Stop them leaving the theatre. The orchestra, he stops the orchestra, from leaving, says, you've got to play the whole concert again so we can record it and I can deliver it to Comrade Stalin. And by then, half the orchestra have left and the conductor's gone out. So he has to, he's stuck. They can't recreate it. So he has to find a nearby conductor who knows the work, and he has to go and they have to knock him up and get him out of bed, drag him out of bed, bring him into the concert hall and get him to conduct the orchestra again and assemble enough of the orchestra to recreate the classical concert that Stalin has demanded a recording of. And this incident is actually rooted in reality. It has a certain amount of comic embellishment, but it's actually true. And you know, that's the insanity of a totalitarian society, where everyone is, because as I always say, it's completely arbitrary. It's completely capricious. You can be at 27 Elm Street and the knock on the door won't come for you, but it'll come for the guy at 29 Elm Street. It's always arbitrary. It's always capricious. The death of Stalin captures that brilliantly. It also captures the insanity that arises when you live that way, so that you think it's like the orchestra and the audience are streaming out, you have to stop them, and half the violin section has left, so you got to find a couple of other violin players. The conductor's had some turn, so he's drunk, he can't do it, so you got to find another conductor to take his place. And you think, you watch this vision of Soviet totalitarianism and you think that's the insanity that a society lives with 24/7. And then you bring it back to us. Here we are in the hyperpower of the United States in the year 2019, when possible presidential nominee of the Democrat Party is a woman who claimed to be Harvard Law School's first woman of color and claimed to be an American Indian because she is 1,024th Native American, so-called, where you have a governor of Virginia who is under pressure to resign because he wore blackface in the 80s, and he gives a press conference and he has to be restrained from his wife from demonstrating how good he is at doing the Michael Jackson moonwalk. And the only reason he doesn't resign is because his place would be taken by his lieutenant governor, who is Me Too'd and is accused of sexual assault. He didn't do blackface because he is black, but he's got some sexual assault problem from the John Kerry presidential convention in Boston in 2004. And if he resigns, I think it would be, the attorney, then you've got the attorney general. He also wore blackface in the 90s. This is as crazy as the opening scene of the death of Stalin. And that is actually the madness and insanity when you have this identity politics, the sort of identity politics pan. On the one hand, there's people who are genuinely multicultural, like the Muslim Democrat congresswoman who got into the country. She was married to her brother for the purposes of some immigration thing. That's fine. You can't question that. But meanwhile, and then meanwhile, you've got all these weird characters on the Democrat side who pretend to be black, pretend to be Cherokee. Because that's what's been incentivized. That's as nutty as anything in The Death of Stalin. Anyway, I enjoyed that movie. And if you would like to... maybe we'll write about it. Maybe we'll write about it at some point before we go on. Wait a minute. Did we get to... let's see if we got one more question on any... we've got time, otherwise we're going to have to. Toby Pillig says, have the woke Stapo struck again against Liam Neeson? We all love Liam Neeson. He's like, he used to be all, when you watch him in Love Actually, it's almost unwatchable that he's all so mopey and moony. But he's great when he's killing Albanians, slaughtering Albanians in Taken. And now he's, the woke Stapo struck against him. For actually what was intended to be a moment of atonement. We don't really have time to get into that, but I tell you what, we're going to... I think we'll do a Stein post on that, because I'm interested in that. But anyway, I always love Liam Neeson, just the way he... the number of people he guns down in those Taken movies. And Taken 2 is incredible. Taken 2 is an incredible movie. I love the way he just... He's got this terrible, the terrible daughter who gets taken, who looks about 37 or whatever she is there. I don't know quite, but she's supposed to be a high school girl, I think. And I love the way he goes, you're about to be taken. And when she is taken, in the second film, it's the wife who gets taken, and the daughter has this rather unsuitable boyfriend. But at the end of the film, where they're all back in California and they're laughing and whooping it up, having slaughtered half the population of Albania, and they're at some soda fountain and they're all having chocolate malts. There's Liam Neeson and there's the missus and there's the daughter and there's the boyfriend, and she says, oh, I really like this. She puts her hands on the boyfriend's shoulder and says, I really like this one, Dad. Please don't shoot him. Great stuff. Who doesn't like it? But now it looks like poor old Liam Neeson has shot himself in the foot. So we will attend to that on the next Stein post in a couple of days. But thank you very much for your and we'll, you know, we always pick up on the extra mail in the video mailbox as well. And I do come and see me and Dennis Miller, because we're going to have some fun. And we're going to take your questions too. So it'll actually be like a Clubland Q&A or a Mark's Mailbox. At the end of the evening, we're going to take a big bunch of your questions, completely unscripted, no telling what will happen. It all kicks off Reading, Pennsylvania, on the 22nd of this month, so that's in a couple of weeks' time. Syracuse on the 23rd in New York. Then Rochester and the dreaded Wilkes-Barre. You can go to adorabledeplorabletour.com and get your tickets. But be aware that if you want good seats for Reading, you really ought to book now and get them now. And we will look forward to taking all your questions then. And we will see you next time on our next Clubland Q&A.